Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, has Francis Ford Coppola flown too close to the sun with his new epic movie, Megalopolis? We talk to Peter De Bruges of Variety about what the great director may have been thinking. Blur to the End, a brilliant new documentary about the band reforming and playing Wembley. I talk to its director, Toby L. Plus, we review all the week's new movie releases, including the much talked about The Outrun, starring Saoirse Ronan. I'm open on Twitter, John_Fardy, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the News Talk app powered by Go Loud, and it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on News Talk. Good weekend to you all. I hope you're doing well and life is treating you well. Now, I was stopped during the week. I was on a public transport, and as I've told you before, often happens, no one knows what I look like, but occasionally people go, are you the guy off the radio, when they hear me talk, because I was on my phone, and a guy said to me, are you the fellow off the radio who does the movies? And I said, yes, indeed I am. And he said, Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice, shite, and kind of walked off. So it was a fun interaction. But other people have enjoyed Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice, and I have. And if you want to listen back to my interview with Willem Dafoe or indeed Michael Keaton, it is all up there on the News Talk app or the News Talk Player or wherever you get your podcast. Now, in TV this week, I was watching this.
When I was a kid, I was a gangster. Real old school type. Rex Calabrese. He was a big deal. He helped people. You know, someone in your family was sick, you find you a doctor, short on rent, front you the cash. Knew everyone's names too. Don't know how he kept them all in his head, but if he saw you on the street, he'd call out to you, ask how you were. Felt like he meant it too. When I'm 14 or something, he has a heart attack and dies. Still holding a cigar. In my neighborhood, they throw a parade in his honor. Can you imagine to be remembered like that?
That is a clip from The Penguin, starring Colin Farrell, who is unrecognizable. If you saw the most recent iteration of Batman, The Batman, with Robert Pattinson, he is the character from that. And in this, he plays the same Penguin, but he's Oz. He's a guy on the up. He's a henchman in a family. He's had a pretty difficult life, a strange relationship with his mother. He looks a bit different. Colin Farrell is wearing all kinds of prosthetics on this. He looks nothing like himself in this. And he plays this middle management criminal who's attempting, in essence, to take over the Falcone crime empire. And it's an origin story of how the Penguin became the Penguin. And what I love about this, it's on Sky, it's on Now TV, it's dropping weekly. I've watched the first four. We were talking about Unpack Kenny this week. It's continuing this trend of, here's a superhero show that has nothing to do with superheroes. Because this is a crime drama, and a pretty goddamn fine one as well. Very twisty. Colin Farrell is brilliant in it, hopping from side to side in these various crime gangs. He takes a young kid under his arm who's been kind of left homeless and destitute, but has a criminal interest himself. Really very entertaining so far, four episodes in. As I say, Colin Farrell, I have a feeling, is going to sweep up at next year's Emmys, because it's quite a transformation. And as you heard there, you can't even really recognise him in voice or indeed how he looks. I mean, his eyes look kind of the same. That's about all I could recognise him in. But he's absolutely brilliant in this. I think this is a really good crime drama with some nice flourishes in it. And as I say, it's pretty much devoid of superhero stuff. And Joker, which we're going to talk about next week, because I'm talking to the director, Todd Phillips. The movie's called Folie à Deux. Cool name for part two. Is so not a superhero movie. If you thought the first one wasn't a superhero movie, the second one is not. But more of that next week. Back to The Penguin on Sky. I think it's a mighty good TV show so far. Do let me know if you might have been watching that. You can email me screentime@newstalk.com or my Twitter handle is John_Fardy. Now you're listening to Screen Time News Talk's TV and movie show. We turn to the week's new cinema releases. Chief among them is the new Saoirse Ronan project, The Outrun. We're also going to look at the new Pitt-Clooney pairing in Wolves. And God help us, Hellboy is back, The Crooked Man. More of that anon. I'm joined now by film journalist, arts critic, man of many monikers, Chris Wasser. Chris, hello, sir.
John, how are you?
Very well. So listen, I don't say this that often, but I've actually read the book, The Outrun, because I went to a kind of press day for a cinema and they had a tote bag and in it was The Outrun.
Okay.
So I actually read it. So I'm aware of this story, but for people much less literate than I, tell us what's going on in The Outrun.
You know what? I'm ashamed to say that I think I was at either the same press day or a different one, but I came away from a screening of this film with the novel or with the memoir, and I still haven't read it. And I would very much like to after watching this film, because it's based on a memoir by Amy Liptrot. She is adapting her own work here with the German filmmaker Nora Fingscheid. I hope I'm pronouncing her name correctly there. And although, you know, it's a factual based story, I was reading a wonderful piece written by Amy for The Guardian there during the week, where she was talking about the fact that in order to, you know, improve, in order to ensure a better experience for herself adapting this and seeing her own life on the screen, there were certain artistic liberties taken. You know, they decided to rename the character. That's why, you know, if you're going to see it, Saoirse Ronan, who's playing the Amy Liptrot character, her name is now Rona. A sibling character was removed. There were various kind of incidents kind of added or taken away. Mm-hmm. But that's sort of part and parcel with these kinds of stories, with these fan-based tales. The film itself is a little bit, despite the fact that it is based on a book, I mean, there are times where I was sitting there watching it thinking this is almost pure cinema, because it's a little bit plotless. But the basic outline is that you have Rona, played magnificently by Saoirse Ronan, but we'll get into her performance later. And she is a young 20-something who has, you know, raised in the Scottish Islands and went off to London for college and career and all the rest of it. And, you know, does the same thing that every other kind of late teen or 20-something does, which is, you know, you party a lot when you go to college. But unfortunately, the party never stopped. And Rona, as it turns out, is an alcoholic. And she is just, she's trying her best to kind of, you know, defeat this disease as it is, but it's just not working. And she's sort of lost, you know, 10 years of her life just on and off. And, you know, her parents, you know, who are actually separated, one of them has gone down the devout Christian route. The other is actually quite mentally unwell, but still trying to, you know, carve out a living for himself. They have enough kind of problems of their own. And I think it got to the stage with Rona where it's like, she's going to have to do this for herself. And we watch her accept that finally and decide that in order to heal herself, if she has any chance, and in order to remedy her mistakes and mend her, you know, relationships with her mother and father, she's just going to have to isolate herself from the rest of the world. So she disappears to the Scottish Islands near where she was raised, right at the, you know, right in the middle of nowhere, John, and on the edge of the world in the Orkney Islands. And
Orkney Islands, which are the most remote of remote islands, really.
Oh, I mean, the area where she was moving to, I think there was something like less than 30 people living. So she is in this cottage by herself. She gets a job. She's battling the elements every day, but she's also battling this disease. And that's the basic outline. And actually, I've probably made it sound, you know, very straightforward, quite linear, but it's anything but.
Yeah. Okay. So from the book, I mean, the book was reasonably linear in that, you know, we have her having this crisis in London and then, in essence, finding herself on the Orkney Islands. But you're saying there's a lot of kind of cinematic flourishes here.
That's it, yeah. I mean, the best way I can describe it is that it's a difficult film and it makes things difficult for itself and for the audience, but it's a brilliant one. And although that, you know, although that angular structure, although, you know, kind of going back and forth and seeing her on the islands or seeing her living her life in London and flashbacks of relationships that just went terribly wrong because she's just, you know, she's just crippled with this disease, basically. You know, that there's an awful lot of jumping around. There's an awful lot of, you know, blinding visuals, whether it's in a club or whether we're kind of seeing things from the perspective of Rona, who's really struggling. It takes an awful long time to settle and get used to, but it does eventually settle. You know, it is quite artful, it is experimental, but I think what helps it is just that muscular, magnificent performance from Saoirse Ronan. I mean, she is just the anchor of the film. And of course she is, because she's in every single scene. But I think it's so strange. I mean, we're talking about a four-time Academy Award nominee here. And every time there's a new Saoirse Ronan film, it feels like in Ireland anyway, because everyone wants to talk to her and she's on, you know, every platform, whether it's print or digital or television. We kind of treat it as an event. But films like this should be treated as an event, because you don't see a performance like this often. Whatever problems I had with the film, and it does kind of overextend itself a little bit, there's too many endings, you know, it just goes on a bit longer than it should. The performance is just sensational. And I mean, how many other actors, and it's easy to say this because she's Irish and you kind of feel like you want to support her, but if it was a bad performance, we would say it. How many other performers have been doing this as long as Saoirse Ronan has, and are still discovering new ways to just completely bowl you over? I think that's a very short list.
Yeah, and she's still so very young. You know, I'm kicking myself that I haven't seen this. One, because I read the book, and two, because I was actually one of those people who was probably going to get to talk to her, but I couldn't make the screening. I did, in my defense, put my family first, but let's not get into that now, Chris. So her performance is towering. Is it the best performance of her career? Are you going to go that far, or is that maybe overstating it?
No, I think so. It's probably not the strongest film of her career, but it's certainly the strongest performance, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. I think it does. But it's extraordinarily honest, you know. And Saoirse Ronan has been doing the rounds and saying that, you know, you'd be hard pressed to find a person who hasn't, in some way, whether through family, friends, or acquaintances, been, you know, impacted and affected by this disease. And they went into this, you know, whether it was Nora, whether it was Amy, the writers, the crew, the producers. I think this film was actually co-produced by Saoirse Ronan's Jack Lowden. Mm-hmm. There's not a person here who went into this for the wrong reasons. They wanted to tell the story in an honest and, you know, truthful and also respectable way. And I think they've done a phenomenal job with it. It is such an honest depiction of alcoholism. It's a terrific performance. And I mean, even John, you're getting into like tricky accent territory. That Scottish accent, particularly from the region that Amy Liptrot is from, not an easy thing to do. But you are never, put it this way, it's not Braveheart territory. You know, it's actually, but halfway through it, you actually start to convince yourself that Saoirse Ronan could be Scottish. So
at no point do you think she sounds like she's from Carlow in it or anything like that?
No. The Carlow's gone. Other kind of accent that she's had on screen before pales in comparison to this. It really is. I'll say it. Look, it's a bit tricky at times. Doesn't make it easy for you. The scenery is unreal. I mean, you can feel the cold, you can feel the chill and the rain and just sometimes the misery just like sticking to you in this film. But it stays with you. Great performance, strong film. I should hope that this actually ends up, kind of making an impact during award season. I hope it lasts that long.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like it could. So what are you going to say stars-wise for The Outrun?
I think four out of five.
4 out of 5. Excellent. Well, that is in cinemas from this Friday, the 27th of September. Chris Wasser gives it 4 stars. Let's take a quick clip.
Danon, I'm so sorry. Whatever I did, I'm not drinking anymore. I'm sorry.
And I'm so tired of hearing you say that. I can't hear you say that again.
What do you mean?
I don't even recognize you anymore. But I wish you were a completely different person.
Don't say that.
I can't do this.
What do you mean you can't do this?
I just can't do this.
Did I do that to you? I'll never do that again, right? Whatever I did, I'll never do it again. I'm never gonna drink again. I promise you. Right, because I don't want to lose you. I don't want to lose you. Please don't.
That's a clip from The Outrun, which is on general release from this Friday, the 27th. So, Pitt and Clooney are back, this time on a movie on Apple TV called Wolves. The coolest pairing in modern cinema, perhaps. Is this a cool movie, Chris?
I think it's probably a little too cool at times, but you know, look, it's a magnificent
pairing. It sounds like we worked that out, but we didn't.
We didn't. No, it's see how the script is. But look, it's Pitt and Clooney. Straight away, you're like, well, that's 4 stars. You know, the only way it can go is down from here. And it sometimes does, unfortunately. But there's a neat setup. You actually have Pitt and Clooney playing nameless characters. And I'm not really sure if that was intentional, but, you know, it works. So I'll be addressing them from here on out as Clooney and as Pitt. But what you have is you've got Gorgeous George portraying a professional fixer, you know, an underworld fixer, let's say, who, you know, cleans up the messes that rich people can't, basically. And we're talking about some serious messes here. And he's called upon to clean up this murder, basically, in a swanky New York
and
hotel
sorry
room.
To interrupt you, but that brings us very close to the wolf character from those years ago in Pulp Fiction. Are they aping that, or is that a knowing nod to that?
I think so. It has to be. I mean, like, but unlike Harvey Keitel's Winston Wolfe in Pulp Fiction, you know, George and Pitt will have to work together. I can't imagine Harvey Keitel's Wolf working with anyone else. So I think it's a bit of play. I think it's a bit of a play on that. It's a, you know, it's kind of a nod as well to the fact that, you know, these guys don't have names, and also to the fact that they usually work alone. They're lone wolves. But Clooney is called to clean up this mess that the great Amy Ryan has made in her hotel room involving this young sex worker who basically fell off the bed, John, hit his head, and he's not getting up. So she calls up this fixer, but another fixer arrives at the same time, played by Brad Pitt, and neither of these guys know why the other person is there. But someone on a telephone call, someone very important, tells them that it doesn't matter. You need to adapt. You need to work together. So they do that reluctantly, you know, kind of grumbling, and they're very grumpy. And one of them kind of has, different methods from the other. And then all of a sudden, one of them finds $250,000 worth of heroin in the room. And then it turns out the dead body isn't quite as dead as they thought. So I think if I reveal any more, we'd certainly be getting into spoiler territory. Yeah. Because there is a bit of fun there, but that's the basic setup.
Okay, you know, sounds like a decent enough vehicle for Clooney and Pitt. Is it a decent vehicle?
They've made better films, and I don't think either of them could really say that this is the best thing that they've done. You know, it's a very bumpy buddy comedy, and it is a comedy. You know, it kind of has, it kind of fancies itself as a bit of a dark thriller. It's not, it's definitely a comedy. Okay. I think what works against it is it's very glossy and sanitized. It's far too clean. It's far too handsome a film. You're just like, I wish this film was a bit grittier. I wish these characters didn't just look as though they've come straight from the makeup and dressing department. Like, they just, everyone and everything just looks too perfect in it. And also, despite the fact that is a fun setup, it's nowhere near as clever as it thinks it is. And it kind of ties itself up in all kinds of knots the longer it goes on. So a little bit convoluted, but at the same time, you just can't help but like these guys in a film together.
Yeah.
And they keep you watching, and they keep wolves working even when it shouldn't. I mean, it's just that charisma they have between them. You know, there's the Redford and Newman spark. I mean, this film sometimes fancies itself as a bit of a Butch Cassidy sort of setup, you know, in more ways than one. And they really are just wonderful together. And they acknowledge their age throughout the film. And there's all these kind of little nods, you know, if someone's trying to chase down the dead body who isn't quite dead, you know, they do have to stop and catch their breath. If they are reading, you know, messages that, you know, on a phone or a pager, as it is in this thing, you know, they both have to take the glasses out. There's the occasional kind of nod. It's like, yeah, these guys are not as young as they used to be, but they still know when to act tough. They know when to look cool. And they also know when to laugh at themselves. And I just, I couldn't help but like it.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, well, you see, it sounds to me, and I haven't seen it, unfortunately, but it's just the powerhouse of charm, and their friendship nearly carries it.
It does. It shines through. They're blurring that line of, you know, yes, you're watching fictional film characters here, but you're also watching old pals just kind of just spark off of one another. And that's exactly what they do. You know, there's some wonderful supporting players in there, but it really is the Clooney and Pitt show. Unfortunately, it was to receive a cinema release. It was supposed to have a limited cinema release, if not just in America, then, you know, throughout Europe. And this kind of this premiere, John, at the Venice International Film Festival.
Yeah, because they were over there doing the rounds.
Yeah, I mean, films that premiere at the Venice International Film Festival, they'll probably end up on streaming at one stage, but they go into cinemas first. But for whatever reason, it was a theatrical release was pulled. And it's something that Clooney was talking about not being too happy about. Even Richard Kind, who pops up in here for a minute, he was talking to I think it might have been the Hollywood Reporter, and he was saying that he shouldn't say this, but he thinks it might have been a bit of a communal movie. And I think what he was getting at was that, you know, a lot of heads sat in a room and said, look at the box office figures for every other film that gets a theatrical release before we put it on our streaming service. We're not going to do that with this. In other words, the decision was completely taken off the filmmaker's hands, taken out of Clooney and Pitt's hands, who produced it. And that's a shame, because Clooney and Pitt, they're supposed to be on the big screen.
Yeah, no, absolutely, absolutely. He's 63 now. By golly, he's in great nick, Mr. Clooney, isn't he? I mean, I was just watching clips of it beforehand, and he just, I don't know, he could, I mean, he look. I suppose, I'm not going to say he could pass for 40, but he's still in fine form in terms of running around, and it's like, it's, he's defying the sands of time, it seems.
Oh, he's in fabulous nick. I mean, I'm not even sure I'll look that good at 43. So it's, you are sitting there kind of rubbing your eyes as you watch the screen thinking, yeah, these guys are so beautiful. It's actually, it hurts to look at them. But it's more than that. You know, they still do have it. You know, there's some lovely little touches in there. There's enough there to keep you watching. And also, John Watts made this. And I do have an awful lot of time for him, because he made the three best Marvel films from recent years, anyway, from the Marvel Cinematic Universe. He made all of the Tom Holland Spider-Man films. So he knows what he's doing. So you've got a decent manager. You've got some old school movie star magic there. Some nice little turns from Amy Ryan and from Richard Kind. There's enough there. It's not great, but there are worse ways to pass the time.
What are you going to say stars-wise for Wolves?
I'd say a solid 3.
Solid 3. I'm just wondering, am I meant to say Wolves or Wolfs?
Wolfs. I mean, I know. Do you know what, John? When I was actually submitting a print review of this, I was hoping that an editor wouldn't correct me, you know, because it's intentionally Wolfs. I mean, it's such a clunky title. It probably doesn't work. It looks cool on the screen, but there's something about it where you just can't help, you know, go, oh, I want to correct that. So I'm not too sure about it.
Well, that is Wolfs. WOLFS on Apple TV from this Friday, the 27th of September. And you're giving it 3 stars.
Yeah, a solid 3.
Solid 3. Fantastic. Okay, in 2 minutes, Chris, not to put you under pressure, but Hellboy, the Crooked Man, Hellboy is back. By golly, what's he doing this time?
Hellboy, this time he's not even hanging about to give us a proper introduction or any sort of context. This is like the second Hellboy reboot, because we had the Guillermo del Toro films, and then we had a reboot with David Harbour a few years ago that was just disastrous. So this is another reboot. It's quite low budget. It's directed by Brian Taylor. It's actually co-written by the creator of the comics, Mike Mignola, and it goes straight into it. It's like, look, newcomers beware, this is definitely one for hardcore Hellboy enthusiasts. And we're just transported immediately to 1950s America, where Hellboy, played by Jack Kessy, who actually plays Hellboy, gets more humanity out of Hellboy basically than Ron Perlman and David Harbour before him. But here's all you need to know. He is the titular Red Demon of the Peace. He works for, you know, a paranormal investigation bureau, and he's been assigned to investigate all things paranormal in rural America. And he's making his way across 1950s Appalachia, basically, with his rookie human agent partner. And they're transporting a spider from A to Z. I don't know where they're supposed to be going with the spider. But long story short, the train crashes. They're derailed. They end up in the mountains. They end up in a small village where, what do you know, there's all sorts of shenanigans going on with devil men and witches. We've got our own Leah McNamara playing one of the witches, and it turns into basically an assignment that they weren't expecting.
Okay, so I put you under time pressure there, but I could hear the enthusiasm trailing off anyway. Is this poor? Or
It is. Yeah. I mean, look, I wanted it to be great, but I think there might come a point when filmmakers just need to give up on Hellboy. And there's a lot of excitement about the fact that you've got the original creator writing a film, but what works on the pages of a comic book doesn't always triumph on the screen. All I can hear is comic book dialogue, and you know, it's kind of framed and blocked too, like a comic book. And sometimes that's quite effective, but most of the time it's not. I thought it's poorly organized. It's quite flavorless and toneless. Doesn't really know whether it wants to go the fun, the comedy route or, the more kind of recent Evil Dead route. You know, it plays out like a very chilly folk horror at times. I think the biggest problem with it is it's very, very confusing, you know, and look, I was trying so hard to follow the events of this film, and I think even if I was a fan of the comic books, that I don't hate the comic books, I would still struggle to know what was going on half the time, and that's a big problem. So I just thought it was quite clumsy, John.
Yeah, okay. And it's the Mike Mignola, who created the whole series, he's back again. But this is the third outing, as you say, so there is a slight sense of, why are we reimagining it again?
Yeah, look, if Guillermo del Toro wasn't even, and I know people like the Guillermo del Toro Hellboy films, and you know they had their moments, but I just don't think this. I've never seen a Hellboy film and thought, oh, I want to watch another one. So it just didn't work.
Yeah, fair enough. So what are we going to say stars wise for Hellboy the Crooked Man?
It has to be two. I will say, look, the cast seem to be enjoying themselves. Liam McNamara is having a ball as the witch, and Jack Kessy again tries to bring a bit more humanity to a character that's always kind of portrayed as this terrifying kind of Hulk, you know, monstrous beast, but it's just the film around them just deserves better.
Hellboy, the movie that makes you not want to see another one of them, as Chris Wasser says, 2 out of 5, which is in cinemas from this Friday, the 27th of September. But if you've been listening to the entirety of this review, or you've just tuned in, the thing to see in the cinema undoubtedly this week sounds like it is The Outrun, which Chris gave 4 stars to. Chris, thanks a million.
Thanks, John.
After the break, we're talking about another new movie released this week, a somewhat bizarre movie from Francis Ford Coppola that's getting a lot of column inches for possibly wrong reasons. I'm talking about Megalopolis. It's even hard to say. Apparently, it's even harder to watch in some sense. We'll find out more after the break. Now you're welcome back to Screen Time News Talk's TV and movie show. Now, perhaps the biggest and indeed most anticipated and even strangest movie release of the week is Francis Ford Coppola's new movie, Megalopolis, where in an alternative future America, architects, artists and politicians battle for the soul of New Rome, which is kind of a New York-esque city. Now, whatever about the movie, it's gaining lots of column mentions for the fact that it's dividing critics. Some people loathing it, some people loving it. It also has taken a very long time to make. Francis Ford Coppola has been talking about this for a very long time. He's also pumped a huge amount of his own money into it. There are also some offset issues which our legal people might like us not to get into. So to talk a bit more about this, we had to go international, and I'm delighted to say I'm joined now by the chief film critic at Variety, Peter De Bruges, to make some sense of this. Hello, Peter, how are you?
Hi, John. Doing fine. Funny, I had to go international to see this movie. It premiered at the Cannes Film Festival, even though, of course, it's an American film by one of our most revered directors.
Wow. So you were there in the audience. What was the length of the standing ovation?
Oh, you know what? I don't give a flying flip about that. That's, you know, a bunch of malarkey. It's every film gets an obligatory standing ovation, and the length of it is rarely related to the quality of the film.
Yeah, okay. So listen, just I gave it a short kind of pithy introduction there, but you know, we don't have time to go through the plot, and the plot is pretty convoluted as well. But we have Adam Driver as some kind of what exactly? What's his character?
Well, he's a lot like the character in Ayn Rand's The Fountainhead. He's a sort of visionary architect in a world that doesn't understand him. And, you know, that's all well and good. It's clear that someone like that could be easily seen as a stand-in for a visionary director who, you know, is trying to do something outside the box. And so I think it's pretty clear that Coppola's identification point is with that character.
Yeah. And then what's the action happening in the movie exactly? Is it a battle for this new Rome?
It's a very expansive cast of terrific actors. I mean, you know, people that we've loved in other films and that we'd fully expect to do great here. You've got John Voight as kind of like the elder billionaire who's, you know, got his hands in government. You've got Lawrence Fishburne playing sort of the chauffeur butler. Aubrey Plaza is a kind of like exploitative TV journalist named Wow Platinum. You know, the idea is we're being plunged into the midst of city government and city planning, which is not the sexiest milieu to set a film, but it is a, you know, kind of place where big ideas can kind of crash into one another and you know, foment all sorts of other ideas in the minds of the audience. So it's ambitious setting, but it feels very bureaucratic, and it's a bit confused the way that, you know, everyone's kind of wearing togas and going to arena shows in the midst of, you know, kind of philosophical arguments about the fate of this New York-like city.
And, you know, I've read, you see, I haven't got to see it yet, unfortunately. I had childcare issues I won't bore you with. But what, you know, people are referring it to it as a kind of metaphor, you know, possibly for Coppola's life. Or for, but like, what is it a metaphor for, do you think? Or could you see one?
Oh, sure. I mean, I think it could be seen as a metaphor for any, you know, number of things. The idea here is that you've got both a city, but also any sort of creation. So that could be filmmaking, et cetera. And, you know, we've seen Coppola deal with these kind of themes before: greed and corruption and power, you know, betrayal and loyalty, you know, who believes in whom, who's backstabbing. You know, those things go back to The Godfather. Although this movie does not feel like it was made by the same person. It feels like it was made by someone who forgot everything that he learned in the making of earlier masterpieces in his career. You know, 45 years before this premiered at Cannes, Apocalypse Now premiered there. And that, of course, was a very divisive film that I think we kind of all look back on as a incontrovertible masterpiece. I don't think the division on this film is going to settle into that same thing. If so, I'm on the wrong side of history. But I think because I find the movie to be a kind of ambitious mess, but definitely a mess. And, you know, kind of one that hurts the eyes and feels like its director is trying to stay hip and current with a commentary that was intended right around the year 2001, but then 9/11 happened, and a lot of the kind of themes in the big city, you know, being hit by an asteroid and having to rebuild, these kind of things would not have flown any longer in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. So it's waited more than 20 years, and it's kind of fallen farther and farther out of touch, I think.
Yeah, so like meat and potatoes time, is this an unadulterated mess or a mess where you can admire some of the things in the window?
Oh, I mean, I think it's the kind of movie that I want everyone to go see because it's a movie that's trying things. I don't think, you know, a movie has to be successful to be interesting. And I love the kind of big swing of it, the ambition and, you know, the kind of degree to which Coppola's invested himself in it. But I think, you know, with science fiction, and this is, you know, near future, but it feels enough different from our current world that it's unquestionably a science fiction movie. You get these kinds of, you know, just wrongheaded visions. And like, I was reminded of a movie that was also a big flopperino at Cannes called Southland Tales, which has tons of ideas in it. You know, it's a movie full of, but it's bonkers as this movie is. You know, a friend described the movie to me as chaotic, and I can't think of a better word for it because there's just too much going on, and it doesn't feel like the actors are on the same wavelength. It doesn't feel like, you know, whatever ideas the director had or wants to get across or, you know, being communicated to the other members of the artistic team. And so, but better a movie that has ideas or that is trying to get us to think, you know, than your kind of Marvel of the week or something like that.
Yeah. Well, but you see, that gets to the nub of it because you clearly admire the ambition of this and you were intrigued and interested, but you probably weren't entertained. So that, not to put words in your mouth, but that brings me to, you know, he sunk 120 million of this, of his own money into it. I mean, in terms of the entertainment factor, and that's not necessarily why we make movies, but he's probably not going to make the money back because this isn't going to fill the multiplexes.
Yeah, no way this movie will make its money back. But I would not say that I was not entertained. I mean, the idea that this movie is like coming in from a kind of parallel dimension means that you're never bored. You never kind of know what's coming next. He's doing weird things, like he had this idea to have a live actor walk on to the, you know, whatever you call that little area between the screen and the front row, and read scripted questions for a news conference in which Adam Driver responds. I love the idea of breaking the fourth wall and involving a live element and all these kind of things. I don't understand a lick of what he was thinking. Like, if you're going to do that, do it in a really interesting, exciting way. This feels like, really clumsy. And I don't know who's going to take that novel idea and run with it. But there are, God bless an artist of his age who could kind of sit on that $120 million of Vineyard money, choosing to kind of invest it in art. I just think what you said about there being critics who have been positive about it, I haven't seen any raves. I think what we've seen are these kind of charitable, I don't quite get it, but you got to admire Coppola for being Coppola. And while you hear a little bit of that in my voice, I want to be clear, this movie is a mess. It does not work. And I don't think whatever he's trying to say with it is going to resonate with audiences.
Yeah, well, you've made that clear. And tell me this, and I don't know how much we can say about this. There were accusations of unpleasant behavior with some extras. I gather at one point he was even possibly engaged in a legal battle with your own publication about some of that. Is that anything that's reached any kind of conclusion, or can we simply not talk about that as things stand?
Yeah, I just really don't know the stories there. I mean, I've read our coverage, and I know that we're being sued, and I think it's probably better to let other people sort that out in boardrooms or courtrooms or however that happens. But I think the movie should be judged as the movie, and whatever that mess was or wasn't, needs to be kind of litigated somewhere else. I hope it doesn't, cloud the way people receive the film.
He's 85 now. I presume, well, I don't know, but maybe you might know, is this his last movie?
It's hard to say. I mean, you've got a new film from Clint Eastwood, who's, I think, 92 now, coming out this year. I can't imagine, that the movies that, let's put it this way, the movies he made prior to Megalopolis were much smaller in scale.
Yeah.
It would not be hard to marshal another film like that. But this feels like something that's meant to kind of be his final word on things, not in a kind of grim way, but just it's so ambitious that, what's left to say and who is going to want to be in business with Coppola after this, because financially it's not, a responsible project.
Yeah. Well, you know what, if nothing else, it's a fascinating antidote to modern Hollywood in some ways, even the story of it. And let me finally ask you then, we use a crude metric on this show where we give, stars out of five. You've said this is an interesting mess. What if you had to, if I had a gun to your head and you had to give a star rating for Megalopolis, what would it be?
Yeah, it's probably a two. I think it's not a disaster in that you can see that there's intent there, but it's much closer to the disaster end of the spectrum than the end where we're used to seeing Coppola, operate. I mean, The Conversation for me is a masterpiece.
Yes.
The two Godfather films, this is a maestro in it. And, when we were talking about whether I was entertained or not, what I was really experiencing was this kind of soul imploding feeling where you kind of just want to hold your head in your hands as you go deeper and deeper into this movie and think, I hoped what I was hearing was wrong. Maybe I've, lowered expectations of your listeners enough that they will see more in it than I did. But I just, you're going farther and farther down a road, from which he won't recover. And
yeah.
It's that kind of, that kind of tragedy for me. You want this movie to be better than it was.
Yeah. Yeah. And as you say, The Conversation and of course, Apocalypse Now, and two of the three Godfather movies are probably staples of your cinematic imagination. They certainly are of mine, but it's two stars, occasionally described as soul imploding. I've been delighted to talk to the chief film critic of Variety, Peter De Bruges. Peter, thanks a million.
Thanks for having me, John.
Imagine today's society as a branch of civilization about to reach a dead end. Is this way we're living the only one that's available to us? My plan is a city that people can dream about.
Megalopolis.
What about those standing in your way? Who like it the way it is?
People don't need dreams. People need help now. Don't let the now destroy the forever.
The clip there from the somewhat unwielding Megalopolis, which I was talking to the great Peter de Bruges there from Variety, their lead critic. After the break, Blur to the End. Now you're welcome back to the last part of Screen Time. And we turn now to the great band Blur, for there is a new documentary called Blur to the End, which is a feature-length documentary depicting the extraordinary and sometimes emotional return of Blur, captured during the year in which they made a surprise return with their first record in 8 years, the acclaimed The Ballad of Darren. Blur to the End follows the unique relationship of the four friends and band members, and the sometimes up and down relationship that they all have, despite the love they clearly have for each other. Damon Albarn, Graham Coxon, Alex James and Dave Rowntree, as they come together to record new songs ahead of their sold out first ever shows at London's Wembley Stadium in 2023. The documentary features performances of their most iconic music, footage of the band in the studio and life on the road. And it's kind of an intimate portrait of getting back together and figuring out how they're going to play these massive shows in Wembley. And they go to smaller gigs along the way. And Toby L is the man who directed it. He got some great access, and it's a bit of a cliche, but it is warts and all, because there are problems in the band. Sometimes you feel Damon Albarn doesn't want to be there. Sometimes you feel none of them want to be there, and yet they all are driven to be in Blur a lot of the time as well. So it's a great documentary, also being released, and I should say Blur to the End is being released on DVD and Blu-ray on Monday, the 30th of September. There's also a digital release as well. People love to own DVDs and Blu-rays, particularly of music documentaries. There's also a release of their live show at Wembley, Blur Live at Wembley, which is a brilliant concert movie. It really is. You really feel like you're there. There's 20 cameras and it's just joyous return of a band we thought we might possibly never see again. Toby L also directed the live show at Wembley Stadium. So I spoke to him about Blur to the End and also about Blur Live at Wembley Stadium. Hi, Toby.
Hello, darling. How you doing?
I'm better now. So, Toby, I'm like you, a big fan of Blur, and what came across, which I already knew, but really came across in your documentary, is these are four people who love each other, but it's very complicated and it's very brittle at times. And they themselves, particularly, well, all of them really, are brittle as well. So I wonder, when you're heading into this, are you like, you know, caution advised, I need to mind these people? Or is a part of you thinking, because you are a movie maker, there's going to be documentary gold in this because these people have a fraught relationship at times?
That's a really good question. I think the thing is that you have to straddle two things, right? You've got your admiration for what they've done as a band. That's why you're there. You're there because you appreciate their work. You're passionate about it. You're knowledgeable about it. However, you almost have to throw that part of your brain in the bin a bit, because if there's going to be any sense of integrity or reality or honesty to the filmmaking, you have to capture what's happening. And you can't just be there sycophantically sort of like fanning out. You need to just allow real life to happen, and you need to sort of, you know, capture it as openly and honestly as you can. So for me, what's staggering is you do see the warts and all, for want of a less cliched phrase. You know, you do see the ups and downs in the documentary of the band's relationship and their dynamics. And I really think it's credit to them that they were open and happy for that to be depicted. I think there are a lot of bands of stadium level, of their legendary status level, They would never allow that to happen. But I think it's to their credit, because I think what it does for the viewer is it allows the viewer to go, hang on a minute, I bicker with my friends and my family, and, you know, it's okay because we make up afterwards and we get on with it. And that's the thing, we're in such a conflict-averse world, which ironically leads to bigger conflicts because we're not talking about things. And this film is an attempt to philosophize and show the emotional side of friendship and relationships. And yeah, I hope it gets that across, really, for whether people know Blur or not.
Yeah, no, it absolutely does. And I mean, all bands that are worth their salt and go the distance, there may be a pun in there, you know, they have this kind of stuff, from U2 to the Stones to maybe not Coldplay, but let's not get into that now. Tell me this, did they give you, like, obviously they trust you to let you in like this, but were there ground rules where, you know, because it is very raw at times, but did they say, here is where you can and can't go? Presumably they did in some fashion.
Not hugely. I mean, the main thing that we all agreed is it had to be real. Like, you know, there's a lot of stylized, slick, quite frankly, phony documentaries coming out at the moment. And there have been for a few years now. And as much as they can be entertaining and a good Saturday night bit of fodder, for me, it's trash. It's like reality telly, you know. And look, we can all enjoy junk food every now and then. I'm not trying to sound puritanical. We all enjoy a cheeky bit of junk food, but we know when we're watching something that's not honest. And for us, we were like talking about documentaries we loved, and they were just a bit more raw, a bit more fly on the wall. They gave you a truer sense of the person. And so in that regard, once we had all agreed that as the ground rules, let's do something more intimate and honest and handheld and not set up, that was the basis under which we started the filming, really.
Yeah. Tell me this, you know, I kind of knew this, but I was struck by it again watching your movie. Like, Damien Albarn is a musical workaholic. And, you know, I felt like shouting at him, going, stop, just, you know, go swim in the sea, go have a pint with Alex Moore. Like, you're working too hard. And he's coming back from Coachella and he's falling asleep at a keyboard and he's going, it's fine. Like, like, did you have a sense of that, like, you as the director and the fellow band members, that there's a frustration that you just need to stop? I know it's very easy for me to say that I'm not a genius, he is, but I'm wondering where you sat in all that.
It's a really good question again. I mean, the thing is that Damon's process of writing and creating music and art, that is just his breathing, you know, that's his being and his breathing and his hobby and his vocation and how he unwinds. It's like, it's everything to him. It's that process is just sort of endless. And I guess the outside looking in, that is like workaholism, because it means that he's always creating and then touring it. But for him, he construes it differently, that he feels unsettled, I believe, if he's not always making music and presenting and performing it. So that's just the way he's wired. And that, I guess that's what makes him not only prolific, but just quite an extraordinary artist, really.
Yeah. Now, all roads are leading to Wembley. And there's great footage of the guys talking about watching Live Aid from there. And, like, even for an Irish audience, like, Wembley, you know, it's such an iconic venue. I've been there for gigs and for football matches, and we watch Live Aid in Dublin. But I thought it was great that, you know, on the road to Wembley, they're playing in, you know, less majestic places like Colchester and I think Wolverhampton at one time. You must have been pleased as a documentary maker that was going to be part of the process, that they were going to gig up in these smaller venues and not necessarily know how they were going to go.
Absolutely. I always think it's nice to go on a journey literally when you're making these sorts of films, because going out, seeing the sights, you know, there's a lot of like kind of like everyday, you know, shots of the UK in there and everyday life and buses and people going to work. And I kind of just like getting the snapshot of the era as much as telling the overall story. And I think it adds another layer to what is society in 2023 and 2024, you know, like where are we at as a species? And there is some sort of like conversation about, you know, lightly some political societal considerations considerations, because obviously over 30 years ago, the band released the album Modern Life is Rubbish. And we explore that as a bit of a theme. You know, is modern life still rubbish? What's the mood of the world right now? And I think we can obviously come to our own conclusions on that. So, it was an opportunity as much as anything to show the band going back to their roots, but also showing a contemporary story of, you know, who we all are now and what it's like to go around the country.
Yeah, and Damien says somewhere in it about, you know, I wrote these songs 30 years ago, but, you know, they are not prescient, but they make a lot of sense now. And the film shows that. Tell me, the actual gig in Wembley is, and people may be aware of it anyway, but it's joyous. 20 cameras, apparently. Is that a logistical nightmare?
It is for a lot of incredible, talented producers that handle the logistics. No, for me, it's just a creative
You just
challenge.
Look at the rushes and go, oh, no, darling.
Yeah, exactly. No. I mean, obviously, it's a huge undertaking. It took months of preparation and work to, you know, figure out how we were going to engineer and wire and cable and set up the shoot on that side. You know, I've got an amazing production team with my partner Josh and Katie, who's our producer, and the whole mini city of people that we built to create that shoot. And it was 110 crew, 20 cameras. The edit, we have 3,000 different shots in the concert film. There were three editors.
Wow.
It really was like a labor of love that we spent many months on the post-production to try and really create the energy and the atmosphere of what it's like to be at Wembley.
Yeah, it so came across. It's so well done. You know, people can find the set list, so I hope it's not a spoiler, but, you know, it ends with Universal, or the Universal. God, it's... Like, I always thought it was a great song, but it's such a brilliant rendition of it, and the perfect place to end the concert. And, like, I presume you knew the set list in advance and you knew they're going to end with the Universal, and because that could go wrong, I suppose. You know, it just seems so perfect, Blur playing the Universal at the end of their gig in Wembley. But, I mean, you don't know how it's going to come off, but it came off and then some.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, you never know what a band's going to play. But we had the fortunate insight, because we'd gone on the road for the documentary with them to some of those smaller venues in different towns, as you mentioned earlier, that we kind of knew what they were building up as a sort of repertoire for the Wembley gigs. And yeah, I think it's 25 songs, it's 2 hours, it's hit after hit. It's emotional roller coaster, to use that cliche, in terms of all of the different energies and atmospheres and variety of songs. You know, there's comedy in the show, there are heartbreaking, tear-jerking ballads, there are epic punk rock songs. It really does have the whole gamut of human emotion, this show, I think.
Yeah. So, and again, it's a spoiler of sorts, but the documentary ends with him kind of driving away, going, that's that for now. I'm sure you're asked this all morning, but, like, do you think Blur are done for, you know, ever? Or do you think there'll be another manifestation, that the clouds will align again, or the stars will align again?
I really hope that they do, you know. I think, but the thing is as well, the film is like, it's inconclusive, even though it's called To the End.
Yeah.
To the End is ultimately ambiguous. It's like To the End, as in it's the end of something,
yeah,
but equally To the End, in that sort of superhero thing. It's almost like to infinity and beyond, you know. It's that sort of almost like kind of sentiment, that rallying call. So it's intentionally ambiguous, and the ending is left open-ended. That said, you know, if it were the end, it would feel very satisfying, because the, you know, a bunch of old friends coming back to do their one of their best ever albums, and also to sort of pay their biggest ever shows, it would be a beautiful place to leave it. But equally as well, I think the compulsion to create music in Blur for all four members, I suspect that there'll be an itch that needs scratching at the right point. At least I hope so anyway.
Yes, yeah, so do I. I wonder, will that itch be intensified by two Mancunian brothers getting back together? But we'll have to wait and see. I don't want to get into that now, because there was ticket headaches here in Ireland about that. We're talking about Blur. Lovely to talk to you, Toby, and continued success.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure. Thanks for your time. Have a great day.
Concrete floor polished, so everything sounds insane and bad. It's a great way to make you feel awful about everything you're doing. And then they've got all these silly lights, and some of them are, like, I look down at my fretboard and I'm blinded by these stupid lights. It's as far away as creating music together as you can possibly get when you start incorporating all this. But, you know, Wembley's a big stage, so we have to, like, employ all these people because they've decided to come to a venue that is so large, they're going to see ant-like figures, like I did when I saw the Osmonds in the early 70s.
A clip there from Blur, To the End, which is available now on DVD and Blu-ray. Well, it's available on Monday, the 30th of September, to get your hands on that, as is Blur Live at Wembley, which is a glorious concert film. And you heard me talking to the director of that, Toby L, and there in that clip you heard Graham Coxon sounding like he didn't want to play a gig. And there's a lot of stuff like that in Blur To the End. A great watch. That is it for this week. Next week on the show, I'm going to be talking to the director of Joker, Folie à Deux, the new Joker movie, Todd Phillips, who also gave us movies like The Hangover and Due Date, as well as the new iteration of the Joker. So all of that to come next week. In the meantime, if you want to get in touch with me at any stage, John_Fardy is my Twitter handle. Or you can email me, screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app or wherever you get your podcasts. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on Newstalk. Thank you for listening. Have a safe week ahead, and I'll talk to you all next week.